This is Culturetopia, your weekly dose of culture love from your friends at National Public Radio. I'm Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
I'm Justine Kennan, roaming news producer, arts maven, and mom.
Welcome, Justine. And just to remind you, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia.
This week, we have a review of the new Michael Moore film, a documentary look at Newark, New Jersey, a very busy Juliette Binoche,
and a conversation about turning novels into comic books, an interview with novelist James Ellroy, and a few philosophical minutes with TV talk show host Craig Ferguson.
But first, we'll hear from a sleazebag.
Excuse me?
Not a real sleazebag. Comedian Aziz Ansari plays one on TV with Amy Poehler on NBC's new show, Parks and Recreation. And he stopped by to chat with NPR's Madeline Brand.
You're not from here, right?
No, I'm from South Carolina.
But you moved to South Carolina from where?
My mother's uterus.
But you were conceived in Libya, right?
Wow, no. I was conceived in America. My parents are Indian.
Where did the name Haverford come from?
My birth name is Darwish Zabir Ishmael Ghani. Then I changed it to Tom Haverford because, you know, brown guys with funny sounding Muslim names don't make it really far in politics.
So did you actually make up a lot of that, make up that character?
I am really from South Carolina. That's my cousin's name, Darwish Ghani, and so I just did that so he would get teased at school.
Your cousin, Darwish?
Yeah.
Well, okay, let's get back to you and your character. You play a character, Tom Haverford, on Parks and Recreation.
Yes.
Who, well, describe him for us.
Amy Poehler plays Leslie Knope, who's the deputy director of the Parks and Recreation Department, and Tom is basically her right-hand man, basically like an administrative assistant. So, you know, my character, I think, is a little bit savvier. And, yeah, I'm just usually with her for all these hijinks that we go through in the show.
And you're kind of, well, you're kind of a jerk.
Yeah, I'm really sleazy. I hit on women a lot. It's a fun attitude to play. It's always fun to play a dude who's kind of a sleazebag.
And then in that clip we just heard, she thinks that you're from Libya. I mean, do you play off the ethnic humor a lot?
No, not really. I think it's a point of pride for the show that my character could be played by a white guy, but they ended up hiring me.
So tell me a little bit about how you got this role and what you want to make out of it.
I just finished two seasons of this sketch comedy show I did on MTV called Human Giant. Greg Daniels and Mike Schur, the guys who created this show, knew who I was from that show. They met with me and basically said, you know, we're working on this new show. It's going to be like The Office, documentary style. We're not really sure what it's going to be. And we'd like you to be a part of it. As far as my goal, I was just thinking about this, is to eventually, like after a few seasons, for some reason get fired and then have to be replaced by another Indian guy with a beard. Like, do you remember like on sitcoms, every now and then, like it'd be like the next season, then there'd be like, what happened to the mom? It's that's a different actor.
I just want
that. It hasn't happened in a while, and I want that to happen. I want to be replaced by another Indian guy that looks kind of like me.
Have you ever worked in an office situation like that?
The only similar job I had was I worked for NYU Heating, Ventilation, and Air Conditioning. I guess that's the closest thing I've had to a Parks and Recreation job, which is not very close at all.
Was this when you were a student?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm actually, that's really my passion. I'm going to try to save up some money from acting and then go back to working at NYU Heating, Ventilation, and Air Conditioning. Parks and Recreation is kind of like temping, so I can get back to my real love. When you walk through the Boats Library and you feel that cool air, you know, there's a sense of pride, you know? It's like, I did that. I'm the reason why people aren't sweating.
You were in school. You weren't studying comedy. I mean, I don't think you can get a degree at NYU. What
no,
were you studying?
I went to business school thinking, oh, that'll be like a bunch of laid-back kids who aren't sure what they want to do, like me. And instead, it was like really intense kids that were like very focused on finance and, you know, I got to work at Goldman Sachs, you know, et cetera. And I was doing stand-up the whole time while I was in school. And, like, you know, by like my second or third year of doing stand-up, I was like, well, I feel like I could at least make a career out of just touring as a stand-up, so I did that, and I just, you know, finished my marketing. I didn't drop out of school or anything, just didn't want to do that. I didn't feel like it was necessary.
So you have a degree in marketing from NYU.
I do.
You've also been in feature films.
Sure,
Most recently, Funny People.
I was in
Judd
Funny
Apatow's
People. Judd's movie. It was very fun.
And you played Randy.
I played a very obnoxious, loud, silly comedian named Randy, who was basically, a lot of people thought it was like, oh, this is a take on Dane Cook or whoever, and it was more the notion of like, what if Soulja Boy was a stand-up comedian instead of a rapper? I don't know if the NPR audience is hip to Soulja Boy. Soulja Boy is on Fresh Air this week, right?
Right.
He hosts Fresh Air, doesn't he? Soulja Boy tell
him? He fills in for Terry.
Terry does odd weeks, Soulja Boy even weeks. That should be the news segment. All right, now it's time for our news segment. Let's see what's going on in the Middle East. Soulja Boy tell him. Then Soulja Boy breaks it down.
I love this interview. This was hilarious. I sat next to the producer all week while she was working on it. We had the giggles all week, and we decided that Robert Siegel should be known from here on out as Siegel Boy. I want to make that stick. I think that would sound great.
You know, for the purpose of the rest of this podcast, he is officially Siegel Boy.
Excellent. You can hear the rest of the interview on our Culturetopia website.
Documentary filmmaker Michael Moore has a new film out. Kenny Turan took a look, and he has this review.
Capitalism, A Love Story is more than Michael Moore's latest documentary. It's the summation of the movies he's been making for the past 20 years. He lays all the ills of American society at the feet of an out-of-control free market system. He so detests it. He puts priests on camera to talk about capitalism as morally evil.
We're here to get the money back for the American people.
Moore has not lost his provocateur's gift for stirring the pot. But Capitalism, A Love Story misses the narrower focus that gave his earlier films some of their punch. Capitalism is such a huge topic that touching a wide variety of bases may be inevitable, but it's still distracting.
Fill it up. I got more bags. $10 billion probably won't fit in here. We want our money back!
That said, Moore's scattershot is a lot more interesting than some filmmakers' focus. He has not lost his zest for confrontational antics. He surrounds all of Wall Street with yellow crime scene tape to emphasize his low opinion of the area's activities. And he drives an armored car up to AIG corporate headquarters and demands the company return federal bailout funds. The main point Moore wants to make, the thing that drives him craziest, is his notion that capitalism is a scheme set up to make a profit on absolutely anything. It's a system, he says, that has turned American society into a culture that says money is the only value. Perhaps the most startling thing about capitalism is that Michael Moore stands revealed not as some pointy-headed socialist, but as an unreconstructed New Deal Democrat. He admires Franklin D. Roosevelt and feels that the decades-long weakening of unions has fatally weakened America. The fact that this will be a controversial stance says as much about today's political culture as it does about Moore's place in it.
And speaking of political culture, we're moving on to Newark, New Jersey, which has a very charismatic mayor named Cory Booker. Actor and film producer Forrest Whitaker was drawn to the politician's devotion to his city, and he made Booker the focus of a documentary called Brick City. Forrest Whitaker spoke to Madeline Brand about why he produced this project.
So what drew you to Newark and this project?
It's about the story. I think we have many cities like Newark, New Jersey, all across the nation. I think we have them here in Los Angeles. We have them in Detroit. We have them in so many different places. And so I wanted to get a chance to speak about that. And Cory Booker seemed to be the individual that was setting an example that could be used across the country and in some ways maybe even across the world.
And Cory Booker really is a compelling character and really the star of the movie. Mm-hmm. He's, for people who don't know who he is, he's a young African-American mayor. He's sort of in the mold of President Obama, a graduate of Yale and Oxford. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one minute you show him talking to Jewish investors and he speaks Yiddish. He throws out Yiddish phrases. And the next, he's running across town to play midnight basketball in the housing projects.
Yes.
Is he for real? I kept asking myself, this guy, is he too good to be true?
I know. It's an amazing thing to watch him. I think that was what excited me about the project, because it's these individuals like Cory who are so strongly rooted in what their beliefs are and uncompromising about it. And he empowers people, really. he's an extraordinary man.
Well, how is he perceived in Newark? Because he did run against former Mayor Sharp James and lost, and that was the subject of a previous documentary. And there is a scene where you have Amiri Baraka, longtime Newark resident and poet, calling Cory Booker, quote, a white Negro, and he doesn't like him at all. He doesn't like the fact that he's bringing in all these outsiders to run Newark. Is there a feeling, a suspicion in Newark that Booker is just going to use this as a platform for higher office and leave and not really do Newark right?
I think that people are always suspicious of change. They are frightened of it. Here's a man who's coming into the city and saying, we can change things. We can stop the murder rate. We can lower it. We can change the housing problem. We can bring jobs into the city, a city that's been destroyed by all these problems in the past. And he comes in and actively begins to do things. And I think that startles people, that frightens people. And their pessimism gets in the way of their being able to see what's really occurring, because he has accomplished a lot of those things that he spoke of.
He has lowered the crime rate, the murder rate.
The murder rate by 40%. Uh-huh. He lowered it by 40%. I mean, last year in 2008, it was a city that had the greatest reduction in crime.
And you portray this as a very difficult and uphill battle. There's a very compelling scene at Central High School with Roz Baraka. He's the principal of Central High School, Amiri Baraka's son.
Yes.
He is a very compelling character, and he gives a very moving speech to his students after a kid is shot outside the school.
You living this life like it's normal. It is abnormal to go to school, to talk about your friends dying, to not be able to walk home safely from school, to be jumped every other day, to fail everything, to live in squalor, to have people's parents coming outside fighting with them in the middle of the street. This is not normal, to be going to the hospital every other week, to be wearing t-shirts that say rest in peace, to be writing rest in peace on the wall. This is not normal. It's not normal. Nobody else's children do this.
Yeah. That's so powerful.
That's amazing.
It's really moving. There's so many moments in the documentary that are so moving because it's so true. And these children are thinking that it's a normal thing to see death around them, for the classmates to be shot, for them to lose their family and their homes. It's a sad statement. I worked on another documentary about gangs here in Los Angeles. It was called Crips and Bloods, you know, Made in America. And inside of that, there's a quote. And it talks about kids from these urban environments. And it says that a lot of the kids are suffering from more post-traumatic stress syndrome than those in Iraq. Two separate psychological studies showed this, because they're so used to it that the gunshots, they don't react to the gunshots in their own environment, to death, to loss. They understand it or have written it off in certain ways. And I think this man, Roz Baraka, is very inspirational, because he's just trying to give these children a sense of hope and a sense of moving forward in his school, even though there's struggles, even in getting a place for them to learn.
What was great about that interview is we saw another side of Forrest Whitaker, a real thoughtful interview. Another person we talked with this week was Juliette Binoche. She's another busy person out in Hollywood. She sat down with NPR's Robert Siegel. Phyllis.
What are we calling him these days?
Oh, forgive me. For Robert Siegelboy, to fill us in on her drawing, painting, dancing, and acting. Siegelboy, tell us.
I've always painted somehow, and the dance for me is, it's not that I've ever danced before. I exercise quite a lot because I like to be aware of my body, you know, and as an actor, I think it's important, but it's a medium that fascinates me. And I'd say that, you know, as I paint, I'm dancing on the paper, and as I'm dancing on stage, I'm drawing in the space. So it depends how you see things. But still, there's the idea of coming from a very intimate, hidden place inside you and coming out, having the bravery, the courage to expand yourself into a different scale. And that was, for me, that was the excitement of it.
I'd just like to ask you a little bit about English. You went as a teenager to London, was it, to learn English, or to Britain, to... be an au pair?
I was sent, by my mother.
And the idea was you're going to learn English.
Well, the idea is for all teenagers to learn English, because that's your wings, you know, to go into the world anywhere you want to go and talk to people. And so for me, that was, I started dreaming in English when I was 14, because I wanted to not stay French. I didn't want to keep up on being in rules and boundaries. I wanted to be free.
Can you imagine working in a language that you don't speak at all, and line by line being coached to say it? Can one act enough with the rest of one's being to get around the language?
Yeah, I've had this experience several times because I was playing an Afrikaner in South Africa, and I had to learn lines in Afrikaans, which I didn't know. So I learned to say Ramadulis for about 2 weeks.
I believe you implicitly there.
You know, it's the kha and ra at the same time, which is hell. Ramadulis. And in Bosnian, I had to learn some phrases. If I remember, there was something like Recimi, kako je pranje kola, letaka. Well, I can't remember now because it's been years. But, I mean, you've got to learn those things and feel them, of course. It's there's a moment as an actor you feel like, you're there in order to make bridge between the what's going on and people's mind and heart. So they get the sensation of what it feels like to be like. I think it's we're here to make a life more aware, for people being more aware of what's going on in here.
Take a deep breath and catch up to this creative powerhouse by listening to the full interview on our website.
Novelist Orson Scott Card is one of my favorite science fiction writers. He wrote two very influential and popular science fiction books called Ender's Game and Ender's Shadow. The storyline is about children trained to become warriors in a life-and-death struggle against an apparently implacable enemy, and the profound horror that accompanies their success. Orson Scott Card spoke to Talk of the Nation's Neil Conan about making the transition from novels to comic books to graphic novels.
One of the most exciting things about the comic book is that it's not mine. I mean, in the sense that, I was a playwright before I wrote fiction, and I found that my plays worked best when someone else directed them. When I direct them myself, we get only my original vision plus whatever the actors contribute. When somebody else directs them, then you get someone else's well of creativity, and if they're very good, it enriches everything. And that's what's happened with the comic books, is that the script writers are superb, and they've done a much better job than any of the script writers of the screen adaptation of Ender's Game have done, of finding the essence of the story, making it visual, allowing the reader to experience it with their eyes as well as their imagination and their ears. And so I'm really thrilled with what they've done in enriching the experience. I only hope the movie eventually can be as good.
Do you get any sort of editorial control over the comic books? Do they run ideas past you? Do they say, here's how we plan to do it?
I absolutely have veto power over anything. What I discovered very soon in the process is that the writers, Scott Yost, especially with Ender's Game, but both writers and both artists are doing such a wonderful job that they soon won my trust. And I really don't pay as close attention now as I did before. In the setup, though, in the start, I was intensely involved to make sure that we built the world properly, that the character development was right. In fact, I even provided them with photographs of two young men that I knew who I thought looked the way I wanted the main characters of Ender and Bean to look. And they followed that really quite well. They have a good feeling. In fact, I brought one of the young men with me to a signing of the comic book, and people recognized him from the book. It was kind of fun. So I feel like they have been completely responsive. Marvel is very respectful of other people's intellectual property, partly, I think, because of their own experience with developing and protecting their own. So they have been extraordinarily generous with me.
As a longtime producer on Talk of the Nation, and what many people might realize who are longtime listeners is that Neil Conan is a huge graphic novel junkie. So stay tuned for more graphic novels, no doubt, from him. James Ellroy is a crime novelist, a damn good one. His new books are eagerly awaited by his fans and critics alike. He gave NPR Steve Inskeep a peek behind the curtain of his creativity.
And I can't help but notice that one of the characters at the center of this novel, Don Crutchfield, who we heard about in the introduction, is also an obsessive peeping Tom who tries to turn that obsessiveness into something productive.
Yes, and he does. And he tails one woman, a woman named Joan Rosenkline, throughout the bulk of Blood's a Rover. And I was in love with a woman named Joan up in San Francisco. And she dumped my mangy ass, and the book is dedicated to her. Don Crutchfield is also a real-life private eye.
Really?
People don't know this. Yeah.
Who is he?
Don Crutchfield runs Don Crutchfield Associates. He was a wheel man back in the 60s. He was one of the guys who, as in portrayed in Blood's a Rover, would hang out at a gas station in West Hollywood, wait for calls from divorce lawyers to tail cheating wives and spouses in hot rod cars, kicking the door, and get pictures of the fools in flagrante.
Now, you're giving us a sense of how it is that you write a book. You begin with real people. Some of them are quite famous, President Kennedy or any number of other people. When you plotted out these three giant novels, did you end up with diagrams of characters, or did you simply have it all in your head?
The outline for Blood's a Rover is 397 pages.
The outline?
Yes, just the outline, which is why the book is so dense and flawlessly structured. A book where everything furthers the plot, where every response is calculated, where the ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch is ceaseless.
That's one of the reasons that I wanted you to read that passage at the beginning of the interview about the bug work, the wires, the pliers, the screwdrivers.
Yes.
You've boiled
yes.
it down. It's not even complete sentences sometimes.
Yes. No. No. And it's syncopated. You got that right at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that bug work. Oh, Mr. Inskeep wants me to read this because it's syncopated.
And that's what you're going for. You want it to be rhythmic.
Yeah.
Comedian Craig Ferguson maybe had rhythm in his mind when he told Neil Conan he wanted to be a rock star when he was a kid. He became a late-night TV host instead. That's the short version. Ferguson was on Talk of the Nation to talk about the rest of his story by way of his memoir when he shared this observation about being American.
Yeah, for me, it was I kind of noticed that when I started watching my son playing baseball, which, of course, was a game I never did. I never played baseball as a child, but my son's in Little League. And as I watch all these young American children fail to hit the ball over and over and over again, but be encouraged to keep trying, I realized that baseball is one of the reasons why this is philosophically the best idea anyone ever had for a country, because what you do here is you fail until you succeed, and that's encouraged. Yet failure is seen in America as a necessary byproduct of attempting to succeed, that if you can swing and hit the ball one time in three, you'll make it to the Hall of Fame. In where I grew up, failure was seen, I think, and maybe I'm wrong, and I'm sure there are Scottish people that disagree with me, but the idea that I got is that failure was disgrace. And that I think in America, that's just no one entertains that notion at all.
Do you get perspective? I assume you go back to Glasgow from time to time?
Sure I do, yeah. I mean, and I certainly don't feel I've become less Scottish by becoming an American. I think that, I mean, America is not an ethnicity. America is, for me, a decision. America is a statement of intent. It's a belief system, if you like. It's and I'm fiercely patriotic about being an American. I'm a Scotsman who became an American. You don't put... you know, who you are aside, you add to it by becoming an American.
Well, this podcast was so deeply added to by having you sit in the co-host chair this week. Thank you so much for joining us, Justine.
Nana, it was my pleasure entirely. And next time you're scraping the bottom of the barrel, I hope you find me there.
As our special take-home prize, we'll let you have the final word this week.
Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. I'm sorry I'm not Robert Shigelboy. I am Justine Kennan. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia.
And I'm Neda Ulaby. So long.